So I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Ed Thompson. I killed him.
Order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
And welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 299, Andrew. Oh my gosh, that is a numerological wonder. We're almost to 300. Tell you what, you know what we're doing to celebrate 300? We're having that live show.
Woo!
Tickets. I'll tell you this. Tickets may or may not be still available. I don't actually know. So, so go check. The links are everywhere, I'm sure. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastically well, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, we've got also the new intro quotes now, because we are painstaking, we are accurate over here at Opening Arguments. The new quotes start on 301, just in case everybody's wondering. So that's when to look for the new quotes, because, you know, it's like 1 through 10, 11 through 20, that kind of
yeah,
thing.
So yeah.
301 that's will be the new quote.
Two excellent numerological points to begin this law podcast.
That's what I bring to the table. All right. All right. I am excited for today's show. We get an update on Joey Salads, the character that everybody's been asking for more of. No, that's a real person, but we're going to hear more about him. And we're going to talk a little bit about emoluments. We've got some updates. Then we've got Worcester versus V. Georgia. I will not be saying Worcester or however people would say that. Do they? That's a good question. When people say
Worcester.
Yeah, when people say, okay, so it's Worcester, that's what people say?
Worcester is what you say, yes.
And then when you add the Shire to it, it becomes Worcestershire.
Worcestershire, yeah, exactly.
I refuse to...
Which is a delightful anchovy-based sauce of which I use all the time.
I refuse to play that game, so for me it is Worcestershire sauce. I have time to say it. I'm not in a rush. I'm not doing it. You know, maybe if like... The bomb's about to explode, you know, and it's like, quick, give me the password to disarm this bomb. Then, and only then, would I say, Worcestershire. That's the only time. And it's like the critical 0.2 seconds was needed for them to like type in Worcestershire to the thing. But that might be harder because then they're going to be like, how do I spell that? Is W-O-O-S-H-O-O-O-S-H? That's all, because that's all anyone says.
Whoosh.
And then they'll have to be like, come again. And I'll say Worcestershire, and then it'll explode. The whole thing just explodes. So Worcester v. Georgia is what we're talking about. And we get a little Andrew was wrong in the C segment. I wonder if we'll conveniently run out of time for that. No, I'm just kidding. You would never do that. You would never play the timing game to get out of an Andrew was wrong. We're going to hear all about that. So what do you say? Let's get going.
Yeah, let's do it.
You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad. You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad.
Okay, so Joey Salads. I've been dying to know. What? Update me on Joey Salads.
This clown horn. Okay, so yeah, two updates coming out of OA 297 from last week. The opening segment, we talked about the Second Circuit's ruling in Knight First Amendment Institute versus Trump, which related to tweeting and whether a public official can turn an online social media platform into a limited use public forum. We made fun of Joey Salads. You don't win friends with salad. Filing a lawsuit against AOC for blocking him on Twitter for him being a dumbass YouTube troll. We said, yes, you can block trolls on Twitter. That's not what this stands for. our buddy Jeff Blackwell, Council for American Atheists, sent me a message to point out he went through the PACER docket, and all Joey Salads did was fill out the uniform complaint forms off of the court's website, and so he has not actually filed the lawsuit at all.
Total Salads move.
Salads
this guy is.
It's, you know, he says he's got, I don't know, a million followers on YouTube. Maybe you don't make any money with a million followers on YouTube or whatever. But like, I think he knows that filing this complaint is not worth the cost of filing the complaint. And so he's like, I'm going to sue AOC. But by sue, I mean write on a piece of paper and put it on my website as opposed to, you know, actually file a complaint with an actual court against an actual person, which he does not have a chance in hell of winning. So I thought that was a fun update on Mr. Salads.
So just for us uninitiated salesmen here, there's a complaint form, but not, that doesn't mean you did it. You didn't.
Right. What those forms are, and both state courts and federal courts will have form instructions. Even lawyers will often use those, right? Like, because this is the court saying, hey, if you send this in this format, then it's presumptively okay. Right. Mm-hmm. And with complaints, courts will provide that because we allow individuals to represent themselves in court. And so when you are a pro se litigant, the court is trying to help you out. Right. They're like, look, we're just going to give you a Mad Lib style sort of fill in the blank. Right. Know what it is. Right. Yeah.
All right. I need a noun, a verb, and a tort.
Exactly. And you know, you just fill in the blanks, which is, again, that's a totally reasonable thing for a pro se plaintiff to do. It's probably not a thing you do if you are a, you know, if you fancy yourself as running for Congress and being a sophisticated party and actually being aggrieved, right? Like, you'd be like, Joey, hire a lawyer. Don't just scrawl in crayon on the form. But there's nothing inherently wrong with filling out the form. But again, I could call, right? Like, I draft up a complaint tomorrow, and until I file it with the court and they date stamp it and I pay the money, I've just written stuff on a piece of paper. Stuff on a piece of paper, you know.
In fairness to him, he probably got some vinaigrette on it and was like, "Oh, I can't file this now. It's all oily."
Yeah, something like that. So, so there you go. Joey Salads has not actually sued.
All right, an adjective, a gerund,
AOC.
And a subsection. I don't know. All right, well, that's fun. Well, we'll see if he ever turns in his oil-soaked complaint there.
We will see.
What's our emoluments update?
Yeah, I got a lovely email from our buddy Seth Barrett Tillman, who still listens to the show, and wrote in to say, I think, I am not sure, that you erred in asserting that Frosch, that's our buddy Brian Frosch, Attorney General of Maryland, stated he will seek Supreme Court review. As far as I know, all the two AGs have said is that they'd seek further relief. What that means, I'm not entirely sure. It may mean that they will seek en banc review from the full Fourth Circuit, which, as you indicated on your show, is somewhat more liberal than the panel and has a majority of Democratic-appointed judges, depending on how you count judges with multiple affiliations and multiple appointments to different courts. I totally agree with that. That is absolutely within the range of relief that it is possible that the AGs will seek, and probably a better course of action than immediately appealing to the Supreme Court. So really, really good correction there. He continues. He says, Judge Macit in Maryland squarely rejected the Tillman position in regard to the scope of the Foreign Emoluments Clause. That's right. We covered that in episode 232. However, that view went to the merits and is vacated as a result of the Fourth Circuit's conclusion that the plaintiffs in the Fourth Circuit lack standing. Also true. Judge Sullivan in D.C. did not expressly reach the question as to the correctness of the Tillman view because the DOJ was unwilling to argue it, but he assumed that my view was incorrect. That decision is now before the D.C. Circuit, also because the DOJ filed a mandamus petition, just as it did in the Fourth Circuit. Again, interlocutory relief. You don't usually get review from a denial of a motion to dismiss, but you can then file the mandamus petition. Really, really good point. That gives yet another court the opportunity to pass on that. We'll see. One of the things, like we said in 297, one of the things I continue to respect about Professor Tillman is his candor in, you know, describing sort of where his position is. In addition to correctly describing that the Maryland case may go to an en banc full Fourth Circuit, or at least that may be the relief that they try to seek. And I think that they have a decent shot of getting. I mean, you know, I mean that in the same way that I mean a cert petition has a decent shot of being heard. These are all low probability events, but this certainly seems to be the kind of case as a matter of first impression that you could see the entire Fourth Circuit saying, maybe we should all take a crack at this instead of a not representative panel of you know, pretty conservative panel. So I think they have a chance of getting that heard on bonk, and that probably is some relief that probably is the relief that they will seek in the interim. I also added, and we are 100% going to do this. I've not gone back to listen. There's a little bit of a challenge at the end. Professor Tillman says, you, in a common moment or two, you ought to go back to how you conclude OA 36. That was a second part of our interview, and compare it to your position on originalism at the end of, and he says 287, but I think he means 297. This is all about originalism. And then he says, you take entirely opposite positions. I'd be surprised at that. I don't, again, I'm doing it before I have gone back and listened. So I'm going to be completely transparent and accountable on it. I think we're overdue for a bit more on originalism on the show, and I'm happy to rise to the challenge, and I will do that. So that's I've been called out as taking opposite positions from 36 to 297, and stay tuned.
Can't think of what that would be. How do you think originalism is still as relevant, or are we kind of entering some new phase? You know, like, I don't hear, and maybe it's just because I'm not personally following it or something, but like, I don't hear a lot of words about originalism as jurisprudence from our two new Supreme Court justices. Is it there, or is it more unsaid? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's because the project of mainstreaming an extreme minority view on jurisprudence has worked.
Yeah,
worked, right? So you don't, the kinds of things that John Roberts and Samuel Alito had to say in their confirmation hearings are now sort of implicitly understood, right? Like they were arguing for the validity of the originalist position by making the kinds of arguments that, you know, that we've talked about, that again, that I think are patently wrong, right? The originalism ensures that you're just the umpire calling balls and strikes, and that this is judicial minimalism and, you know, and the opposite, and restraint, and the opposite of activism. And so obviously the rise of originalism, it was really formative with, you know, it was coincident with me being in law school and my early career as a lawyer. So so I think that's a really good comment of yours, that I may be emotionally invested in the debate in a way that, from a practical perspective, that, you know, it's sort of moved on. And again, we say this, but I think it's worth pointing out, calling that there is no one originalism, right? Like there are multiple sub flavors kind of within that genre, and yeah. You know,
there's original flavor.
Yeah. Yeah. The Samuel Alito position is the new Coke of originalism. But there are a variety of of sub flavors in terms of how that that comes out.
I like barbecue, you know, flavor originalism. Yeah. It's probably the staple, you know. It's
yeah. All right.
Well, there you have it. So, but just for us non-law people who didn't have all of that stuff freshly on our minds, like you, what did that mean on emoluments? Were you? It's pretty much still over, right? Or are you saying there's other?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, so it is. It is over. It is possible that, and this is, I mean, this is kind of an interesting result. It is possible that the Fourth Circuit may reinstate the district court's ruling, right? So it is entirely possible that if the Attorney's General petition for rehearing en banc, that will be granted. And then, you know, we'll have, it'll be about a year and we'll get a ruling out of the full Fourth Circuit that uphold, probably less. I mean, I'm being pessimistic. I'm thinking of ordinary litigation, but this is not an ordinary case. And so we may get good news coming out of the Fourth Circuit, but that will be temporary and short-lived. I do not think that that this current court is very likely to affirm the district court's holding in this case if an en banc panel were to resuscitate it for the reasons that we discussed in 297. The other case is still pending in D.C. And look, I certainly could imagine that the D.C. Circuit will explicitly stay proceedings until the resolution, either by the full Fourth Circuit or by the Supreme Court. They don't have to. It's a different circuit, right? And the whole idea of the Supreme Court will take cases when there are conflicts among the circuits means that circuits all the time will just, you know, sort of plow ahead with deciding on a case, even though there is litigation pending in another circuit that could be dispositive, because decisions from the Fourth Circuit are not binding on the D.C. Circuit, are not binding on the District of Columbia, and vice versa. So that litigation may go forward. We may get a different result. We'll have to see. So that is a little bit more nuance on what's new in emoluments. I do think from the Yodel Mountain perspective, right? Are we going to get documents from the president's lawyers about his business conflicts of interest not through this process anymore? So,
that's
stand
too
by
bad.
That.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, little update for you. not the best one, but there you go.
And in fact, the day after we recorded this, the D.C. Circuit issued a ruling, and there's some complicated procedural stuff around mandamus. But effectively, what they did was they directed the District Court of the District of Columbia to certify the case for an interlocutory appeal on the questions of standing and cause of action. And again, they didn't quite do it that way because of complicated reasons. And in fact, due to the length here, patrons are going to get a bonus, a little mini extra, breaking down the really, really interesting dual-edged sword here that relates to this opinion citation of a Supreme Court case that came out last month called Virginia House of Delegates versus Bethune-Hill. So look for that in your feed if you're patrons.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Paint Your Life. If you need a gift for somebody, this is a great idea. I had Paint Your Life do a portrait of Lydia and Phoebe. They were on the beach in Hawaii. It was a picture that I actually grabbed from my Instagram, and I turned it into them, and they had their artist do a full painting of it, and it is absolutely beautiful. We have it hanging up in the kids' playroom. I plan to get another one done with Arlo when we get the right photo to do it based on, but I cannot recommend this enough. It is absolutely beautiful, and you can customize it in whatever way you want to with the frame, the size, all that good stuff to make sure it fits the room that you're going for, wherever you want to hang it. But you are left with something that you will have forever, something that you will be proud and happy to hang in your house. I mean, you know, long after Phoebe is no longer that big, I will have this beautiful painting from Paint Your Life that I just cannot recommend enough. And they could do this for any photo. Maybe it's a pet, maybe it's you, maybe it's a place that you like. It could be anything. You give them the photo, they recreate it. And this is a real painting. This is world-class artists creating a real painting from your favorite photo. And I have to say, if you've got a loved one or somebody important to you who has a birthday coming up or maybe an anniversary, that would be a great time. This is a perfect gift. Or maybe you just want this for yourself. That works too. And there is no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded. And right now, as a limited time offer, you can get 30% off your painting. That's right, 30% and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word OA to 484848. That's OA, just the letters OA, to 484848. One more time, text OA to 484848. Message and data rates may apply. Go do this. Paint Your Life is incredible. You will love the painting that you get. I certainly do. And now it's time to move on to some Worcester news. Well, not this is old news. Let's talk about Worcester v. Georgia.
Yeah, so this is a case from 1832. And in fact, I'm going to tell you a little story that goes beyond that. So, earlier than 1832. And it starts with our protagonist, Samuel Worcester, or Samuel Worcester.
Right? Now, you can say it the way that it's supposed to be said, which is Worcester, and I'll say it the way I insist on saying it, which is Worcester, because I've got all the time in the world. I got all the time in the world to say that 0.101 seconds worth of thing.
No, we'll call him Sam. And he was a 19th century social justice warrior. And I mean that sincerely and approving it, right? He went to live among the Cherokee and was one of the first public activists to defend the sovereignty of the Cherokee Nation vis-a-vis the U.S. government. And Sam went about, and so look, like, the United States had a treaty with the Cherokee Nation, recognizing the Cherokee as an independent nation. And then, as you might recall, in the 1820s and 1830s,
everything was totally cool.
Yeah, was right. And we had the same kinds of breakdown of public trust that you might infer from where we are today, right?
Was it like, okay, you guys are a nation unto your own. We recognize that. And now we are going to wipe out this nation that we found. Is it
well,
is that?
And it was more that the United States was trying to kind of put the United States didn't want to be initially in the position of just, you know, wiping out the Cherokee and other Native Americans. There was one of the techniques, for example, was westward expansion, right? These original tribal lands were pretty loosely settled. And so then you would have large numbers of American settlers would encroach upon the tribal sovereignty of the land. They would settle down. And now all of a sudden you're outnumbered in your home lands. Right. And then the Cherokee would go back to, and other Indian nations would do the same thing, would go back to the U.S. government and be like, a whole bunch of people just settled in our lands. And time again, what the government would do would be like, yeah, that's really, really unfortunate. But what are we going to do now? It's not like we're going to kick them off. You know, they're just people. It's not their fault. So why don't you give us some more concessions? We'll move you back a little bit. And we extra super double strength promise that we won't let that happen again. And then it would happen again. And so Sam Worcester was one of the people who opposed this action. And he did some very, very clever stuff to try and defend tribal sovereignty. One of the things he did was he hired a guy named William Wirt, W-I-R-T, who was a former attorney general, right? So this is like hiring Eric Holder, or Bill Barr's not a great example, but, you know, Dick Thornburg, right? Like this is a super, or a better example, even though Ted Olson was solicitor general, he was never attorney general, right? Like this was hiring one of the most prominent lawyers in the country to defend the tribal sovereignty of the Cherokee. And now we enter the first antagonist in this case, which is the legislature of Georgia, which is kind of, if we want to think of Sam Worcester as the social justice warrior of the 1830s, the legislature of Georgia was kind of the center lords of the 1830s, oh, okay. Right? And so the Georgia State Legislature passed a law, right, in 1830, and that law prohibited all white men from living on Native American land within the state of Georgia without a license by the state. And you might look at it and go, oh, that seems right. That seems pretty liberal. That seems designed to stop the kind of problem that we describe, right? Which is sticking a whole bunch of settlers on Native American tribal land and outnumbering them and then pushing them off. And right. But the reason I've described it as kind of the center lord position is the legal ramification of passing this beneficent law was really twofold, right? Number one, notice that the state could issue a license, could issue a permit to you, right? So it's not a super great protection, right? When you're like, we're concerned that states of the United States are sending people to settle on our tribal lands, to say like, okay, well, now we'll make them have to go to other white people and get their permission before we do, right? Yeah, oh, that's not super great. And the real pernicious aspect is by passing that law, that indicates that the state of Georgia has sovereignty over those lands. Right. That they could decide who gets to settle there and who doesn't. And so our protagonist, Sam, decided along with 10 other individuals to engage in an act of civil disobedience. Wasn't called that at the time, but he went out and settled on Cherokee Territory land, disobeying the law so that they could have standing, and indeed, he was arrested, convicted at trial, and sentenced to, because this is 1830, quote, 4 years at hard labor, end quote, which is, you know, sort of actually busting rocks. Of the 11 people who were arrested and sentenced to years and years in prison for violating this law, they were all offered pardons by the governor of the state of Georgia, but we've talked about this before. You don't have to accept a pardon. And Worcester declined his pardon, stayed in jail, and, you know, right, so true kind of civil disobedience, and then litigated the case all the way up to the Supreme Court. Again, the, and I'll just say parenthetically, because we're not going to go down the two prior efforts, you have William Wirt, right? The early 19th century version of Ted Olson, arguing on behalf of the Cherokee Nation and on behalf of Sam. They tried to bring two prior cases arguing for Cherokee sovereignty and lost on procedural grounds. So the courts, right, like, were really, really clear about, hey, anything we can do to try and not bring up this question, is the Cherokee Nation an actual sovereign nation under the treaties as between it and the United States? They tried real hard to punt on. But ultimately, you couldn't punt on this one, right? You have an example of a law that Sam very clearly violated. And it was now up to the courts to decide, did the state of Georgia have that power to pass that law in the first place? And if they did, right, then the state of Georgia has authority over tribal lands. And we can absolutely punish Sam for violating the law. But if they don't, then the Cherokee are a sovereign nation and the conviction has to be vacated.
Wow.
And so those were the stakes. They went to the Supreme Court, and in 1832, in Worcester versus Georgia, ruled in favor of the Cherokee, ruled that the treaty between the United States and the Cherokee Nation absolutely established them as a sovereign independent nation, and that therefore the state of Georgia had no power to pass the kind of law that it did because it was not sovereign over another nation. And so,
I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to me, but you never know.
Like, yeah, it was right. This was John Marshall, right? Certainly at the time, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the one of the most famous Supreme Court justices in history. And when you read this opinion, and I'm going to link the opinion in the show notes, you should read it. It reads like the way it reads very much like a Warren Court opinion, right? It reads in a way that belies. I love this sort of this discussion after originalism, because it is what conservatives today would look at and go, well, this is this is John Marshall, giving his opinion. Well, I want to read a little bit in analyzing one of the provisions of the treaty between the United States and the Cherokee. And
can you remind me when the treaty? Had the treaty been signed recently, or did it date back? I don't remember when the actual treaty was versus when this is happening.
Yeah, there are that treaty dates back to 1791, right? Uh-huh. So, yeah, this is we're 40 years later, right? And here, the Supreme Court is sort of parsing the arguments being advanced before it that say that. This doesn't really establish the Cherokee as a sovereign nation. And one argument in the fourth article of the treaty, which draws the boundary between Cherokee Nation and the citizens of the United States, there was an argument being made about this precise use of the term allotted versus the term hunting ground in the treaty. And this is a really good right. I mean, this is a direct analog of, the arguments about the dictionary definitions of terms right now. And here's what John Marshall says. This is page 552 to 553 of the opinion. He says, is it reasonable to suppose that the Indians who could not write and most probably could not read, who certainly were not critical judges of our language, should distinguish the words allotted from the words marked out? The actual subject of contract was the dividing line between two nations, and their attention may very well supposed to have been confined to that subject, when in fact they were ceding lands to the United States and describing the extent of their cession, it may very well be supposed that they might not understand the term employed as indicating that, instead of granting, they were receiving lands. If the term would admit no other significance, which is not conceded, its being misunderstood is so apparent, results so necessary from the whole transaction, that it must, we think, be taken in the sense in which it was most obviously used. End of quote. What you have there is you have the Supreme Court saying, don't come back and tell me like there was a parse, that there's a way to like carefully parse this and look like they knew they signed it and it must have been and apply the like standards of construction. You're talking about a foreign nation that lacked the ability to make these arguments at the time, and so let's construe this so as to do justice, and that's what the court did.
Wow.
So why is this the pit of despair, and is there a light at the end of the pit of despair?
I'm guessing not, since I don't remember traveling to. The nation doesn't seem to be within the United States anymore. Well, I guess in the same form that it should have been according to this treaty. So I'm guessing things went awry somewhere.
Yeah, it did. So let's talk about that. This is the case. You may have heard the aphorism that one of the nation's most monstrous presidents, of course, the idol of our current president, Donald Trump, Andrew Jackson, was reported when this decision came down to have said, John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it. Right. Which the idea was, great. The Supreme Court says,
which is only a threat if he's a big man talking. Right. No, never mind. I don't want to bring up that old one.
Yeah. And so Right? So that is, it's obvious how we understand that aphorism. That is, that's
any
great.
Any reasonable person would
Yeah, I'm understand. The president, and yeah, the Supreme Court has said that the Cherokee are a sovereign nation, but you know what? I don't care. And I'm the president, I have the army, and the Supreme Court doesn't. And so with respect to Sam in particular, it didn't, I mean, that ended happily, right? It Worcester was freed from jail. The Supreme Court did not carry out any other enforcement in terms of, you know, ordering out state militias to defend tribal lands or anything like that. And the immediate aftermath was and by the way, I should add, the fact that the Supreme Court ordered that Sam be freed, that took several months before Georgia complied with
lots
that decision.
Lots of rock breaking in those months, I'm sure.
And then Georgia elected a new governor in 1833, who pardoned Sam in exchange for them ceasing their activities, and Sam accepted that pardon, having won his Supreme Court case.
Why did he still need a pardon?
Well, because remember, a pardon will then expunge that conviction, right? So he was freed by order of the Supreme Court.
Overturned your conviction.
Supreme Court didn't rule, right? Remember, the Supreme Court ruled that Georgia had no power to pass that law, right? But that didn't say it didn't retroactively pull the law from the books, and the state of Georgia was still contesting whether they had the power to authorize the law or not. So this was kind of a cleanup, if you will, in terms of saying, look, if it's ambiguous, why don't I formally pardon you so you will not be deemed to have committed this offense, and there's no ambiguity. Worcester moved into Cherokee territory, and as a result, the Jackson administration's response to this decision was the Indian Removal Act, was the start of the Trail of Tears, in which Native Americans were forcibly removed from their lands and exterminated. That's terrible, and so if you want pit of despair, you know, here is a noble activist, made it all the way up to the Supreme Court, busted rocks in order to have his standing, won, had a populist president scoff, and in the immediate aftermath, that could not stop the forces of history. But at the same time, considerably later, Worcester v. Georgia has had enduring effect, right? It is today why Native American lands are considered sovereign lands. It's not I want to be clear that, right, obviously that's cold comfort to those who were removed, and worse during the Trail of Tears, which is, you know, one of the darkest points in our nation's history. But if you are a believer, as I am, and if you are looking for the light at the bottom of the pit of despair, today, you know, Jackson is largely reviled. Today, the Trail of Tears is considered an abomination, and Worcester v. Georgia is the basis for the Supreme Court's ongoing jurisprudence that tribal lands are sovereign. And I don't mean to suggest that in any way makes up. You know, we're not there. But it does suggest that these things can and do matter, and so that's part of,
you know, and
why
another
I do the
thing
show.
It's part of the stupid culture war that we have, where Republicans are so insulted that we would ever criticize people from back then. I think this goes to show that, like, well, no, it was possible actually to be a white person in this country and not be horrifically awful. In the case of this Sam Worcester, you know, like it actually, it's not like you can just let everyone off the hook because, oh, everyone was horrible. It's like, no, not everybody, actually. It sounds like there were some people who had their heads on straight back then. And so, yes, we can judge Andrew Jackson. And
Get
him the hell off our currency and put somebody who deserves it.
Harriet Tubman. It would be beautiful. And let's also again put into proper context, right? Worcester was a Presbyterian minister, right? His entire activities out among also still out among the Cherokee also still have to be seen in the 19th century context,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's I've taken some liberties here in storytelling, you know, and I want to point out a number of things, right? Like that is, you know, we talked today about the pernicious influence of the religious right. We don't need to sell anybody on that. You know, here was somebody religiously motivated who did an awful lot of good. And then, you know, the add-on
to that. He was probably also awful in some other way. I mean,
right.
Don't
well,
get me wrong.
A, like, there's a colonizing aspect to it, right?
Yeah,
there's a civilizing our little brown brothers. You know, it's hard in history, but I say that to underscore your top line, which I think is 100% correct.
Going to prison for, you know, or whatever, work camp for years for the cause of native sovereignty in 1831, that's pretty crazy. Cool, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean,
I thought so too. And
yeah.
and I got down this rabbit trail because I was thinking about, because AG asked me the same question at the Mueller Schubert live show that you've asked, you know, which is at some point, you know, what happens when the Supreme Court tells Donald Trump to do something and Trump is like, no.
Yeah.
And I instantly thought of that aphorism of, you know, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. Googled that, you know, reverse, got back to the case, and then sort of delved into the case and really kind of fell in love with the story and wanted to share it on the show.
That's awesome. That's the greatest of great old fashioned OA deep dives right there. Good to be back. So, you know, it's what we originally started the show doing, and that was fun. Of course, obviously not the happiest of endings, but still it's interesting history. And, you know, what do you think would be that, you know, what would be the difference then as to now, if Donald Trump did just say, okay, now let you enforce it, even though I don't know that we'll get to that point because they've been able to just take over the court, but
yeah.
Assuming he does something so bad that even this court says no.
Yeah,
then,
well, and look,
what do you
like
think the difference would be?
Right. I mean, that is that was the potential case in the citizenship question, right? Like this Supreme Court said, no, you're not going to include the citizenship question on the census. And Trump was like, yeah, maybe we are anyway. And Bill Barr wrote a memo. I mean, this was kind of a suspect level deep fake on us, right? That Bill Barr wrote a memo that said, no, I'm pretty sure that the president can just put the question on by executive order. And by the way, I'm showing up at the press conference, which happened after we recorded with the president. And all of that was a head fake meant to because I certainly fell for it, you know, meant to deke us into thinking that that they were going to fight on.
Turns out it was Fraser Crane's dad all along. Yeah. And that's a Lot Awful Movies reference, everybody.
Yep.
Go check out Lot Awful Movies 31.
Yep. But no, look, like I have been disappointed at the reactions of the public so far. I continue to hold out hope that if a president begins defying lawful orders of the Supreme Court of the United States, that's a bridge too far, even for Republicans. I hold out some negatron that maybe it isn't. And look, like if it isn't, then I mean that really is kind of the collapse of our system of government, right? I mean, like that is, that is, separation of powers is a farce. The rule of law is made up. It's all just a pretend story. And then get Larry Lessig back on the show, because then I'm with you. It's time to convene an Article 5 convention and say, well, we tried, but now we're going to start over.
I can't wait till we get to the point, you know, a few years from now where I'm asking Andrew, how can we legally make cities a different country than the rural areas? How do we rethink our borders? We'll form a new country, two countries. You can have all the worst places, conservatives that generate no money and just live off the government that you hate, and then liberals will have all the liberal places where things are, and stuff happens and, you know, all that. But it's going to take some creative border drawing. That's my solution to the as part of the Article 5.
To be determined in a future episode.
Yeah. Well, while we're playing hardball, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a fun deep dive into our disturbing, horrible history that we all have as Americans, if you're an American, and that we shouldn't deny because it's horrible. Basically, everyone was the worst. Does that sum it up pretty well?
Yeah, everybody... but eventually, right, that we do have that this did not, this posed a terrible obstacle to the rule of law with terrible consequences at the time. But, you know, eventually the rule of law won out. So I think there's, right?
Well,
I think there's
how optimism. Do you think that? I mean, it's almost like they, okay, you get a pass on this one is what happened. I think that in order for the system to continue, I guess the Supreme Court was like, well, you get to do whatever on this one and then hope listen to us next time, please. And then if they did, then it continued. Is that what happened?
Well, I mean, that is.
Am I wrong?
I brought this up because it's a hard question, and obviously the immediate aftermath is, you know, one of the most horrible periods, despicable periods in our nation's history. So, it did, but I guess my point is that the courts were not cowed into going along with an obviously pretextual reasoning that would have not only permitted the government to do what it did, but cloaked it in an aura of legal of permissibility, and that does have consequences that continue forward to this day, right? Like, it is easy to imagine this case going the other way and our native populations being exterminated today, right? Like not having any notion of sovereignty, not having any notion of tribal rights, and things could be way worse. I'm not trying to put a too rosy a picture on it, right? We call this episode the Black Pit of Despair, right? But there is, right? I believe that the rule of law still matters. So
ever the optimist, Prime,
yep,
Andrew Torres. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims. You've heard us talking about Hims and how they're helping guys look their best. If you haven't yet, it is time to see what they're all about. Did you know that 66% of men start losing their hair by 35? Looking at the calendar, that is coming up. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. So the best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some hair. And you want to know the weirdest thing? Guys turn to bizarre solutions or don't do anything when they can turn to medicine and science. And that's where 4hims.com comes in. They are the one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and sexual wellness for men. And I want to emphasize, these are not snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements. These are real prescription solutions that are backed by science. Now, this is my favorite part about Hims. I don't like going to the doctor. You know, I will go, of course, you should go to the doctor if anything's wrong. Definitely, I'm not against doctors. But when it's something where there could be an alternative where you could go to 4hims.com, connect with a real doctor online, not have to go fill out a bunch of forms, have 7 different nurses ask you the same thing about, you know, like what's wrong with you, and, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed about it, and you got to tell a bunch of people, they got to weigh you for some reason, all that stuff. You can avoid all that by going to 4hims.com. You answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, they can prescribe you medication that will treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. So you've saved at least one trip to the doctor, you've saved a trip to the pharmacy, you're saving on the prescription itself. There is absolutely no reason not to do this. Go to 4hims.com. And if you order now, Our listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to forhims.com/OA. That's forhims.com/OA. One more time, forhims.com/OA.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
All right. Well, you didn't filibuster out of your Andrew is wrong, so let's go to our C segment.
I tried.
You tried. Yeah, I know. I've tried to help you out, too, but we couldn't bail you out. You're forced to confront the truth that you were wrong about something. So here we go.
I certainly was. So in episode 232, I broke down the Bridgegate scandal and the ruling from the Third Circuit. So very briefly, Bridgegate was Chris Christie in a fit of pique, ordered his subordinates, David Wildstein, Bridget Kelly, and Bill Baroni, college colleague of mine, to engage in the pettiest, worst, stupidest act of reprisal to shut down traffic on the George Washington Bridge and direct tons of traffic into the tiny little Democratic village of Fort Lee, New Jersey, right on the New York border, because that mayor had refused to endorse Chris Christie's reelection. And so he was like, all right, well, fine, then have a day's worth of traffic, you bum. Right. And as a result of Christie's political revenge, right, people, I don't know if anybody died, but right, in addition to, you know, when you flood a tiny city with thousands of cars, that interferes with hospital and first responder services. And certainly that happened. So, you know, it has real consequences beyond just, you know, Christie being a jerk and people being, you know, 8 hours late for work. I mean, it created, you know, anyway, that's Bridgegate. And I think all of us kind of wanted to see, Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni, do some time over this. They were, convicted. They appealed, and the Third Circuit affirmed that conviction. They were convicted under, and this is the gravamen of where I was wrong, under 18 U.S.C. 1343, which is wire fraud, and 18 U.S.C. 666, which is theft from a federally funded entity. Bridget Kelly sentenced to 18 months in prison. Bill Baroni sentenced to 2 years. The Third Circuit upheld those convictions, and in episode 232, I said, as our buddy Randall Eliason has kind of thrown back in my face in a good-natured way, there's absolutely no way the Supreme Court would be interested in reviewing this case. Turns out, absolutely no way might have been slightly overstating the case, because a couple of days ago, the Supreme Court granted cert. and has taken up the case. So they absolutely are interested in the Third Circuit's ruling in this case. And I'm going to link to Randall Eliason's article on the Sidebars blog. But Eliason argues, and we can get him on the show. His schedule conflicts this week and next, but we're going to get him on the show to defend this argument. I think he's got a decent argument that under existing precedent that this was stretching the extent of wire fraud and theft from a government entity a bit too far, and that the Supreme Court may reverse those convictions. And so argument there has to do. I am not going to get. We do not have the time to get into the honest services fraud theory. But basically, the question is this, right? This is what Bridget Kelly's lawyers wrote in their cert petition. They framed the question of this case this way: Does a public official defraud the government of its property by advancing a public policy reason for an official decision that is not her subjective real reason for making the decision? And their argument is that's a bad thing, but just lying about why we did something isn't fraud. Mm. And so Randall's got an interesting set of arguments as to that is in fact a fair argument to make. So we'll see. I think there are arguments the other way, and I'd like to hash it out. But the Andrew was wrong. Was definitely I was wrong when I said the Supreme Court wasn't going to be interested in this because they were.
Hmm. All right. Well, I hope you learned your lesson. I don't.
Yeah. My lesson is if at first you do not succeed, never try again. So. That's I'm done. I'm out of the prognostication business.
It's good. It's hard. This is like one of the most difficult to predict anything in times ever. So, you know, no.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Still good to try. And sometimes you get stuff wrong. No big deal.
and always own up to it when I get it wrong. And I was wrong here. I really didn't think that this had significance. I thought it would be narrowly confined to the facts. And I thought the Supreme Court wouldn't want to touch it for fear of being seen as intervening on behalf of scumbags.
There's no fear of
but,
that.
But yeah, okay. No. So apparently,
well, there's where you went wrong. Okay, I see the misapprehension you were under. Okay, well, what do you think? Should we thank our new patrons?
I would love to do that.
That always makes me feel better. Make you feel better. Why don't you start us off? Patreon.com/law. Lot of
okay.
Movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Discount and, tickets. All that good stuff.
Look, if you are not persuaded that you should be a Patreon of the show by now, I don't even know, you know, what else I can do. But I'm gonna try. All right. Thanks to Power User 65536. And by the way, that is 64K in bytes, in binary. Mm. So 65536, power number, power user. To Amy Cheshire, Teresa, Laura Perlman, Dan Kaplan, Tom Ray, Kevin Zezima, to our buddy Kaylee Woomer, Michael Sachs, Nathan Good, to Phi Sergison, shouting out to the Chip Boys. Okay. Zirkle, Linda Cox, and Joe Knessen. Take it away, Thomas.
All right. Patron name Franken got hosed. I don't really support that, but okay, sure. Paul Collier, in the sense that if he had just acted like Trump, maybe, then nothing would have happened to him, I guess, but that's not, we don't want to be that. We don't want to be that. Paul Collier, Jason Brocious, More Pie. Spelled differently, but that's still More Pie. The message comes through loud and clear. FC, Christopher Leonard, Sir Koboku, Alan Champlin, Carla B. Bofill, Melanie, with a weird symbol in it, Igor Kostyochenko, Bonrad Bikles, Belinda M., and finally, Dick Berger.
All right.
Hey, they pledge. We got to say what they want us to say.
Yeah, apparently I missed, either you or I last week missed a genitals related pun. It wasn't, you know, huge erection, but it was something like that where we said it, or, you know, Phil McCracken or something like that. But it was on the order of that. And either you or I, missed the delightful pun. So
that's fine.
Sorry.
Maybe we did it on purpose. Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? All right. You know what this means? T3BE. Time for the answer to T3BE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
I like that. Just feels odd. It rolls off the tongue.
I've got my red eyes going.
Feels so natural. Okay. Thomas, super straightforward question. Civil action for breach of an oral contract. Defendant says, no, we never agreed. We talked about a contract, but we never reached one. What standard of admissibility should the court apply to evidence proffered as relevant to prove whether that contract was in fact formed? I want to tell you first that the fact that this is an action for breach of oral none of that is important in any way whatsoever. Those are all distractors. All this question is
it
going to
be just because it's the same as in anything?
It's the same in any civil action. Okay. All this question is asking is, what does it mean to say whether evidence is relevant? That's all.
Okay.
That's all this question boils down to. So, TTTBE, you eliminated A and C, which is both of those are really, really good eliminations, right? So first you said whether a reasonable juror would find the evidence, this is A, determinative of whether or not a contract was formed. You were like, I don't, maybe this isn't even in front of a jury. Like, that doesn't seem right. And you were almost right in that dismissal. It's not just that not all civil cases are tried before a jury. Many are bench trials.
Well, it's, but it's also determinative too.
Yeah.
Seems like too much for me, but
it's really the case that the judge gets to decide whether evidence is admissible as relevant or not. Right. It's not up to the jury or the judge if it's a bench trial. Right. Like, it's, in other words, it's not a function of the fact finders to decide whether it comes in or not. The judge serves a gatekeeping role of saying, no, this is not likely to lead to the admissibility of relevant evidence. I'm going to keep it out. So it's not up to
the judge. Yeah. Still could be doing so on the basis of whether or not a reasonable juror would something.
Could, right.
Isn't that hypothetically?
Yes, he could, but he doesn't. That's not the standard.
No, I know. I'm just saying that doesn't, what you said doesn't, to a non-lawyer, what you said doesn't contradict this answer.
Understood. So that's why I'm trying to,
gotcha.
to make it more clear. The standard is not put yourself in the minds of the jurors and go, do you think a reasonable juror would be interested in this? The standard is,
it's something else.
Federal rule of evidence 401, right? It is, use your own judgment as the judge to decide whether this comes in or not.
Okay.
So you eliminated A, good elimination. You also eliminated C, also a good elimination. That is, whether the evidence is sufficient to prove, absent contrary evidence, that the contract was or was not formed. That you instantly said, well, that seems like that's way too high a burden, right? And of course it is, right? Like, if each and every piece of evidence, right,
has to
prove the case, then you'd never get any evidence. You could never cumulatively. Right. And then you said, which is the exact right way to answer this question, it seems like if the standard is relevance, then we should look for what the least burden is, which is exactly right. You narrowed it down to B and D. And then inexplicably, you went with D because it sounded like words you'd heard before. When B is by far the most liberal standard, and B is in fact incorporating Rule 401 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which says that evidence is relevant if it, quote, has any tendency to make a fact more or less probable than it would be without the evidence, and that fact is of consequence in determining the civil action before you. So, anything is relevant if it tends to make any fact more or less probable than it would be otherwise. And that fact has to be, related of consequence, which is just a synonym for relevant to the action. So D would be a tougher standard, would keep out more evidence. We don't use it. We use the B standard. So another one of these, you're so close. You're analyzing it correctly.
Hey, and it's T3's just second chance Terminator bar exam is aces. It's just that last thing is now 4 or 5 in a row where I'm tripping up at that. Probability wise, I would think that I should be able to get one of these, but okay. Don't have
I would think
to
so
blame
too.
But myself.
I'm rooting for you.
Yeah, I'm just trying to parse the difference. Whether there's any tendency to make the fact of contract formation more or less probable versus whether the evidence makes it more likely than not. More likely than not. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
well,
honestly,
because, and here's
to not
the thing.
A lawyer, those sound pretty. It's just like, what sounds more like something? I don't know.
Well, because something could be.
Could something be more likely but not more probable or vice
versa?
No.
Like, it's not more likely versus more probable, right? It is that D says whether the evidence makes it more likely than not that a contract was or was not formed, right? In other words, it must be probative of the direct matter before it. And B says it could be probative of anything related to the litigation, right? So clear example of this.
To make the fact of contract formation more or less probable. Okay. Yeah. I think I see what you're saying. That's pretty tough. I don't know.
It is tough. Well, and
going to be too hard on myself for this one is what I'm saying.
You shouldn't be. This is one of these that just is, you know, it's like if I were to take the bar exam again, one of the good, in another state, one of the benefits that I would have is having practiced law for 22 years.
Yeah, that lots would be a of benefit. These.
Yeah, that is, but it's not. It wouldn't be like I couldn't go in and take a cult, right? Like I would have to study to get some of the real property questions that are impossible, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But law students have to do things like memorize Rule 401. I don't have to memorize Rule 401 because I've been litigating it for 22
years. I've lived
years.
Rule 401.
Yeah, I've lived it. It's a part of me.
Squeaks.
It's tattooed on my eyelids.
Academic towers talking about Rule 401. That's my life.
Look, lots of these rules don't come up on an everyday basis.
Wake up every day and I breathe in Rule 401.
And there are plenty of, for example, hearsay exceptions that, I couldn't come up with off the top of my head. I come up with the most common because they come up all the time in civil litigation. But so this standard comes up all the time. And I will tell you, the way in which it comes up is it comes up in discovery disputes, right? Because when you ask a party to produce information and the other side says, why are you asking us to do this? This is irrelevant, right? You come back and you quote Rule 401 and you say, look, relevance is defined as broadly as possible in the federal rules. And if this could introduce any evidence that would have any tendency to make any fact that is related to the action more or less probable, then a court's going to say it's relevant. And, don't tell us that we're on a fishing expedition. We know discovery is a fishing expedition. I'm trying to catch fish here. So, so that's why you see this all the time once you start practicing law. And, it might trip you up a little bit as a law student, but I have a feeling that our lawyers in the audience had no trouble answering this one.
Well, thank you for that dig. I will point out that I am at least one patron's favorite lawyer, and you're the second favorite, so I'll point that out. No, I'm curious, when you hop in your time machine, set that dial, I want to hear, I'm curious how our listeners made figured out the difference between B and D, if they did, because I'm kind of having a hard time. I'm not disputing this or anything. I just think it's one of those things where you've read the rule, and so lawyers have come across or memorized or seen it, and so they know the wording of the rule. But I'm actually I'll have to think on this one. I'm having a hard time personally making sense of the difference here. It seems very, very similar. Maybe after we record, you'll knock some sense into me or something, but this is a tough one. Oh, well, another one I got wrong. I'm now down to 30% or something. Or 50. I don't know where I am.
You're at 55.6%. 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55, 55,
machine.
Yep.
Yeah, hop in that time machine and let us know who won this week's T3BE.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
So, Thomas, a lot of people played along with the first rebranding of T3BE this week, and a lot of folks said things along the lines of what I had just said, which was that you analyzed the question perfectly and then somehow didn't follow that to its logical conclusion. That was Nick Seabrook, John Mellon, and others. Lots of lawyers and law students recognize the language of Rule 401 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, so they got it right, too. But our winner this week is going to be Toasty Ken, that is at Toasty Ken on Twitter, who says, B, because each individual piece of evidence might not be enough on its own, you might need to aggregate many pieces of evidence to win the argument. And that not only correctly gets the answer right, states Rule 401, but gives you exactly the reason why Rule 401 is what it is. Any one piece of evidence might not be sufficient on its own. You want to put all of them together in order to prove your case. So congratulations, Toasty Ken, for getting it right. And everyone, give him a follow on Twitter. That is at TOASTYKEN. Toasty Ken, congratulations on being this week's winner of the first new and improved T3BE.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thanks most of all to our patrons for making the show happen. Go check out those tickets to the live show if they're not sold out. Well, you know, if they are, then maybe there's another live show. I don't know. But either way, we can't wait to see you. And we'll also see you for Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.